given my fondness for salt, you will understand my delight in rereading the book of Job for these two sermons. Because in Job chapter 6, verse 6, we find this: is tasteless food eaten without salt? Now, that's a rhetorical question which naturally expects the answer, of course not. I'm thinking actually that we might do a series of sermons on that verse, which could take us to Christmas if we just rush and do it superficially. Maybe Easter of 2016 if we do justice to all that is buried in that text. Actually, a little comic relief is useful. It goes a long way when you're in Job, because this is one intense story from beginning to end, and it's full of pain. We come back today to the second and last sermon on Job in our larger series on doubt this summer, something that most believers at one point in their life or another have to wrestle with. Want to just, if you'll take out the bulletin insert, you will find a big chunk of the text in front of you. We're just going to summarize it very quickly. These chapters, chapter 1, 2, 3 on the first page, those are my chapter headings, not the book chapters. But I've tried to distill the plot line of Job into 9 chapters or scenes. And the first one is simply the reality that God indeed hides his face from Job. God himself says concerning Satan that Satan incited him, that is God, against Job. He had 11,000 animals, and they all are gone, either stolen or killed. Job and his wife have 10 children, and in one terrific, horrible storm, they all die. And Job moves into profound suffering. You can see that there in chapter 2. And of course, suffering, while we are helped by one another, there is a real sense, and you know this in your own life, those of you who are single particularly know the sense in which, however much help there is, in the end, one carries the burden of pain and suffering alone. Well, we see there, if you look at verse 20 of chapter 1, under the chapter 2 heading, Job suffers. He gets the news that all of his children die. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Well, then Satan comes back, and he gets permission now to afflict Job with his health, and he has these terrific boils, and they itch so much that he can only find relief from scratching with a piece of broken pottery. And his wife says, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. His three friends then come. They're so overwhelmed by his pain and his grief that they just sit there for a whole week and they say nothing to stand in solidarity with him in that pain. Well, after a while, the dam bursts. Job can't hold it in anymore. And so the third movement in the plot is that Job begins to pour out the most incredibly intense complaints against his suffering and really also against the silence of God. Well, his friends can't abide that. His three friends, they're older, most of them, so it seems, and they come to God's defense. They have confidence in their experience and in their age. And really, as someone has said, the essence of what their whole idea is, you find it there in verse 17 of chapter 4. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? That's on the second side of your handout, the end there of chapter 4. Some translations have simply, can a mortal be righteous before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? Well, then comes Elihu. He's younger. He defends God. We said last week that their confidence in themselves is really a kind of arrogance. It's the arrogance of age. It's the arrogance of youth and the idealism of youth. But all of them are really not helpful to Job. In three rounds of speeches among the friends, and then in Elihu's speech, long speech, Job is condemned, and they exonerate God. Now that's as far as we got in the first sermon. We'll come back to the question marks after chapter 6. That's not a typo there. I put those question marks there on purpose. Let's go to the seventh scene, or the seventh chapter in this unfolding story, because now, finally, Job gets what he has asked for. God, in some way, it says that God came to Job in a whirlwind or in a storm. We don't know exactly how the communication took place, but God comes in some more or less direct way to Job, and he confronts him, and Job knows who it is. It's really the climax of the story, and I've titled it, Chapter 7, God Confronts Job to Put Him in His Place. And so we read in Job 38, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand. Now, if you put your finger right there, right after Job 38, verse 4, because of space, we couldn't fit the rest in, but what follows immediately after this, for two whole chapters, chapter 38 and 39, God gives Job nature lessons. Lauding. God is seriously delighting here in the beauty and power and glory of nature, of the fantastic wonders of the natural world that he created and that he still governs. But these nature lessons are peppered with sarcastic remarks and questions from God to Job, like whether Job has ever been successful in even pulling off one sunrise in the morning. Well, God gets to the end of these nature lessons, and he comes back around, and in the opening verses of chapter 40, which you have in front of you, again on the second side of the bulletin, now God again demands an accounting of himself. 40 verse 1, the Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Now here it's very clear that Job did sin. He accused God, and God is holding him to account. He's accused God of wrongdoing. And God says, okay, whoever accuses me of wrongdoing, you come and you answer for it. And God says, in effect, are you going to correct me? Make your case, little man. Let's hear it. Come on, answer me. Now, as you would expect, Job is blown away. You don't have it in front of you, but here's how Job responded to God when God said that. Then Job answered the Lord, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. Okay, Lord, you got me. I say nothing. You've reduced me to silence. But here it gets interesting because God isn't going to let it go. He isn't finished. God immediately goes into lecture mode again, and his sarcasm builds, and he's not going to relent. He's not going to let Job off the ropes. He's not going to cave in and simply feel sorry for Job in his pain. No, he calls him to account once more. Listen, because this also is not in front of you. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself. This is after Job said, okay, I give. I stand in silence. You are the Lord. But God says, no, brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. And for two whole chapters, God gives Job a lecture. Because Job had turned his frustration not only with the way God was dealing with him, but Job had begun to see himself as kind of a model for everybody else, where it seems like those who are weak, those who are marginalized, and those who are doing right always get shafted. And the rich and the powerful and those with influence and without scruples, they seem to get ahead. God says, well, if you have the power to bring all those people to heal, let's see it. But then for two whole chapters, God gives to Job a lecture about these two creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. Now, they're thought by many, there's difference of opinion about what these creatures are, but many think this is the hippopotamus and the crocodile, and that this is a poetic picture of how fierce they are. And hippos, while they look kind of dumpy or something, they are very, very dangerous. So is a crocodile or an alligator. And the point seems to be that if man is no match for a mere animal, how does he dare to think he might be a match for God? Wow. Heavy duty, as we used to say. And what's Job's response this time? You have it in front of you. In Job 42, here now is the next movement, if you will. Job is deeply humbled, and he repents. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, is the sense. Who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Job has put all these questions to God. Now it's God's turn. Job says, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now let's go to the scene, our last chapter, as it were, in the story of Job, because the ending, friends, for anybody who was reading this for the first time, the ending is a total surprise. In chapter 9, God commends and rewards Job, the man who has criticized him and railed against him. He commends him, rewards him, in fact, gives him double of everything that he owned, except the children. He gives him 10 more children, but the first 10, though they died, are still alive, seems to be the implication there. But of all his wealth, he gets double. Job is commended and rewarded, but his friends who defend God, they're condemned. Job 42, verse 7, after the Lord had said these things to Job, He said to Eliphaz, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So now take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me. God repeats it. You have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. And we want to say, wait, Job has spoken what is right about God? The word here really means correct, accurate. After cursing the day that God brought him into the world, after accusing God of not caring a rip about all the injustices in the world, the manipulation, the exploitation of the weak, those who have no political power, no economic power, no social power, after ranting and raving against God for not coming to his rescue, after accusing God of regarding him, Job, as his enemy, after accusing God of pouncing on him. Think of the cat that plays this twisted little game after he's got the mouse and he lets it run a little bit and then the paw, bam, slaps him down. That Job, who would claim to be able to correct God himself from a place of superior insight, that Job has spoken of God what is right. And the three men, we're not quite sure what to make of Elihu. God specifically says here that he's angry with Job's three friends. But these were guys who were defending the honor and the justice of God. And God says he is angry with them because they have spoken folly. What a strange turnaround. What's going on? And the first impression you have is, I must have missed something in reading this whole story. That surprise ending, that God commends the person who has criticized him and condemns those who have defended him. That's part of the literary genius of the author, because that's exactly the response that this ending constrains. Wait a second, I got to go back and read all of Job's speeches and all of the friends' speeches once more. Obviously, I missed something. Which brings us to the second option illustrated in the book of Job for how we respond when we have a deep sense through losses and suffering that God is hiding himself. The first option, remember, was to give the reins entirely to your bitterness and simply to write God off, curse God and die. And a lot of people do that when they encounter pain and loss in their life. The second option is illustrated in Job's friends, and that is just to submit, to throw the towel in, to capitulate to God on the grounds that he must be right because he's God and therefore he's just. So the problem must be with you. You see, in this option, you play it safe, defending God, always imposing an order on a painful and difficult situation, so as not to have to live with things in tension with each other. You invoke the truth that God is just, that everything he does is right, but you wind up caring very little how his justice can be reconciled with his goodness in very specific situations of loss and trouble. You see, Job's friends, they love the truth of God's justice, but they don't have a clue that so often it is past finding out just how the truth that he is just is really to be reconciled with the truth that he is good, that he has promised to be good to his people by blessing them. The friends are eager to invoke order, the order of God's justice. Whether that order is there or not. Why? Well, because when everything becomes explainable to them, that's when they find comfort. But friends, that is comfort on human terms, not on God's terms. G.K. Chesterton has a marvelous little piece on Job, and he says this: "The comforters of Job may be called pessimists rather than optimists. All that they really believe is not that God is good, but that God is so strong that it is much more judicious to call him good. They will keep on saying that everything in the universe fits into everything else, as if there were anything comforting about a number of nasty things all fitting into each other." But Job illustrates the third and the best option for responding to God when God hides himself and hands his people over to pain and suffering. If Job's wife would have him simply write God off, if Job's friends would have Job meekly capitulating to God and simply submitting him without much ado, Job's integrity demands that he takes hold of God and he pulls. A phrase that someone used in a title of a book. Pouring out to God the anguish in his heart and the perplexity in his mind about how in the world God's justice fits together with his goodness in his life, and asking God to show himself sooner or later. Why? Precisely because Job knows that there really is an answer to that complicated and painful puzzle, but it is hidden in the secret counsel of the Almighty. Above all else, friends, Job wants to see God, to hear from him, to be in his glory-filled presence, because then his Father, his God, his Vindicator, would make it all fit together. And then, and only then, would Job find the comfort that his pain made him ache for. Which brings us back to what I have called chapter 6, and what I think, at least, are the major texts in the story where Job, quote, says of God that which is correct, that which is right, that which is accurate. Look now on the back of your bulletin, if you will. Clearly, Job had sinned. He'd sinned much in his rants, his complaints against God, and God confronted him about that, and Job repented of it. But down there in the midst of all those bitter, anguish-filled words, there were remarkably wonderful words that expressed Job's deep and abiding confidence in God. In chapter 13, verse 3, we read, "Then Job replied, 'But I desire to speak to the Almighty and to argue my case with God.'" And then there is this stunning affirmation of confidence in God's justice and in his goodness in verse 15 of Job 13. Speaking of God, he says, "Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face." And then a few verses further down in verse 20. "Only grant me these two things, O God, then I will not hide from you. Withdraw your hand far from me and stop frightening me with your terrors. Then summon me and I will answer, or let me speak, and you reply. And then that great section of Job chapter 19, starting in verse 20, Job was miserable. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped with only the skin of my teeth. Why do you pursue me? He's talking to his friends, as God does. Will you never get enough of my flesh? Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer, my Vindicator lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart aches within me. It literally faints. That could mean long for, or it could mean how my heart is pained within me. And then the last text, starting in Job chapter 23, verse 1. Then Job replied, "Even today my complaint is bitter. God's hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Would he oppose me with great power? No, he would not press charges against me." Job knows that he's innocent in this story. There an upright man could present his case before him, before God, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. But if I go to the east, you see the pain in Job that God is nowhere to be found. If I go to the east, he is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept his way without turning aside. I have not departed from the commands of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. But he stands alone, and who can oppose him? He does whatever he pleases. He carries out his decree against me. And many such plans he still has in store. That is why I am terrified before him. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet, I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face. What a passage. Chesterton summarized it well when he said, "Job argues with his maker because he is proud of his maker. He even speaks of the Almighty as his enemy, but he never doubts at the back of his mind that his enemy has some kind of case which he does not understand." Job is anxious to be convinced. That is, he thinks God could convince him. Job shakes the pillars of the world and strikes insanely at the heavens. He lashes the stars, but it is not to silence them, it is to make them speak. This is why Job longs to see God, to have an audience with him, because at the back of his mind, as Chesterton says, he knows that there is a way that the justice of God and the goodness of God fit together and all is somehow explainable. So the question for you is, what would you call chapter 6? How would you title it? as it stands above those wonderful words of Job, even in the midst of his pain. You can come up with your own way of putting it, but I put it this way. Chapter 6, the integrity of Job's faith and confidence in God, even in the face of fierce doubt. And then I would subtitle it this way, Job's refusal of the easy answer. I hope you can find something in this story for yourself. And for some of you, it may ring true for situations that you have been through. For some, maybe in a situation you're in at present. And maybe for many of us, it's something to be tucked away for the future when we might find ourselves in a similar place. But of course, learning the lessons here from Job are also tremendously helpful when we help one another face the hiddenness of God. Now, in the modern world, there's really another option in responding to God hiding himself and handing us over to pain and to suffering. It is a kind of easy answer. It's given to us by a Jewish rabbi in one of the most influential religious books of our time, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And the rabbi who wrote that book does not invite us to curse God and die just to write God off, but he does invite us explicitly in that book to make a choice between the power of God on one hand or the goodness of God on the other. You cannot have both, he insists. He cannot live with the tension that so racked Job with a desire and ache for the end when God would lay out everything. And all this was precipitated in the rabbi's life by the death of his 14-year-old son at the hands of a horrible genetic disease. And he said he opted for the goodness of God and gave up his power, his omnipotence. Who wants to give up on the omnipotence of God? The God that the Apostle Paul says has the power to bend everything to his purposes. Who wants to give up the goodness of God? What if God's purposes are not good for you and for me? Job refused the easy answer. He refused to cut the tension, as the others did, as his wife did, as his friends did, and as Elihu did too, to a large degree. Job refused. He hung on to God because he knew that somehow, if he were to see God face to face, it would all come together because God himself could explain to him what in the world was happening and how his justice and his goodness meet and kiss one another. Who of us loves God as Job loved him? Who of us has the confidence in God that Job had? Oh, friends, that we might grow in our boldness with God, that we might grow in our honesty with the Almighty, but also that we might grow in our confidence in him, all for a truer and more real and therefore more holy submission to him. Oh, that every last one of us might become more like Job, a great man commended by God, rewarded even after God laid him low. It's complicated. There's tension always. Job sins, and yet he says rich and wonderful and marvelous things about God. Ponder these things even today, before you go to sleep, ask God to make you more like Job in all that made him a good and righteous man. Amen.